On July 15, 2010, Marilyn Buck was released from the Federal Prison Medical Center in Carswell, Texas. Tonight on Circulate Radio, we planned to celebrate the release of Marilyn Buck with many voices of her supporters. While working on the show, another political prisoner, Carlos Alberto Torres, was also released. So then, we planned on celebrating the freedom of both the amazing individuals. We were also planning on mourning the loss of Lolita Lebron, a leader in the struggle for Puerto Rican nationalism, who died this week at 89. Then, August 3rd, Marilyn Buck died from the uterine cancer she developed in prison. Here's a statement from Judy Greenspan. Marilyn died today not in the hospital, but at Sophia Elijah's house, her close friend and attorney with her friends around her. The Federal Bureau of Prisons and the U.S. criminal injustice system killed Marilyn by denying her adequate medical care, careful diagnoses, and timely treatment for her cancer. They allowed the uterine cancer to spread until it was inoperable, and they made her serve every single day of her sentence that they could for her, quote, heinous crimes, unquote, of actively supporting the Black liberation struggle, aiding in the escape of comrade Assata Shakur, participating in military political actions against U.S. wars at home and abroad, and remaining defiant and opposed to the U.S. imperialist racist system every day she was inside the belly of the beast. Our celebration of Marilyn Buck's freedom now becomes a memorial. So, tonight on Circle A Radio, we will celebrate the life of Marilyn Buck and Lolita Lebron and celebrate the freedom of Carlos Alberto Torres. Stay tuned. Marilyn Buck began her anti-racist activism as a teenager in Texas. As a college student, she organized against the war in Vietnam and in solidarity with the Black Liberation Movement. After less than a decade as a political activist, she writes, I went to prison, convicted of procuring firearms for the Black Liberation Army. I faced 10 years in prison, a very long time for a young woman. After serving 4 years, Marilyn was granted a furlough from prison and did not return. She spent the next 8 years underground. Marilyn was recaptured in 1985. In addition to charges related to Assata Shakur's escape, she was convicted of conspiracy to protest government policies through the use of violence against government property. Her total sentence was 80 years. Quote, the trials, those years of intense repression and U.S. government denunciations of my humanity, had beat me up rather badly. Whatever my voice had been, it was left frayed. I could scarcely speak, unquote. Instead, Marilyn wrote, for prisoners, writing is a life raft to save one from drowning in a prison swamp. I could not write a diary or a journal. I was a political prisoner. Everything I had was subject to investigation, invasion, and confiscation. I was a censored person. In defiance, I turned to poetry, an art of speaking sparely but fragrantly. We start with Marilyn Buck, from the CD produced by the Freedom Archives, reading a poem from Wild Poppies, a poetry jam across prison walls.
This call is from a federal prison.
I remember red poppies wild behind the schoolhouse. I didn't want to be there, but I loved to watch the poppies. I used to sit in the window of my room sketching charcoal trees. What happened to those magnolias, to that girl? I went off to college, escaped my father's thunderstorms, Berkeley, rebellion, exhilaration. The Vietnam War, Black Power, Che took me to Chicago, midnight lights under Wacker Drive, uptown, south side, slapped by self-determination for taking Freedom Wall photos without asking. On to California, driving at 3 o'clock in the morning in the mountains. I got it, what self-determination means. A daunting task for a young white woman. I was humbled. Practice is concrete, harder than crystal dream concepts. San Francisco on the front steps at Fulton Street, smoking reefer, drinking bitter dog with Black Panthers and white hippie radicals, talking about when the revolution comes. The revolution did not come. Fred Bennett was missing. We learned he'd been found, ashes, bones, a wedding ring. But later there was Assata's freedom smile. Then I was captured, locked into a cell of sewer water, spirit deflated. I survived, carried on, glad to be like a weed, a wild red poppy, rooted in life.
We now turn to audio from Rag Radio, from KOOP in Austin, Texas, where Marilyn Buck grew up. This show was recorded on June 22nd, 2010. This is host Thorn Dreyer and guest Marion Wizard, both of whom worked with Marilyn Buck on Austin's underground newspaper, The Rag. Marion Wizard starts out by giving some background information about Marilyn Buck.
Marilyn Buck was first arrested and convicted in 1973 for having purchased two boxes of ammunition and supposedly using a false name for them to purchase them and giving them to black men in Oakland who were being hunted through the streets like dogs at that time as the Black Panther Party, as the government tried to exterminate the Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army. If my cousin Beauregard had committed that same offense during hunting season, he would have done 60 days in a county jail. But she was sentenced to 10 years in a federal prison. She served 4 years of that. She was denied parole. She was a model prisoner. They had her working in the prison pharmacy because she was such a model prisoner. The prison authorities recommended her for parole, I believe, 3 times during that time. She was turned down by the government. The government made it quite clear they weren't ever going to let her out. The prison authorities gave her a weekend pass to go visit her lawyer in New York, and she was not seen again by anybody that I know for 8 years. During that time, Marilyn was connected with other fugitive radicals at that time because the white and black movements in this country were being hunted, and she wound up on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. She was involved in a number of actions, including freeing Assata Shakur, who was a black woman, intellectual and liberationist from prison, and some of your listeners might know her better as Tupac's auntie. But Marilyn was also involved in trying to do some fundraising for the black liberation struggle and for the black independence, the Africa movement, which involved armed robbery, which is not a recommended way of fundraising, as it turns out. And some ill-advised results happened as a result of that, but she was also involved in protesting U.S. imperialism. The United States had invaded Grenada back there in 1985, I believe. And also we sent Marines into Lebanon. And so there were several bombs that were set off in public buildings in Washington, D.C., some of which did a good amount of property damage. And eventually Marilyn was arrested, and she and a number of other people were arrested and charged with a variety of crimes, and hers, of course, included being a fugitive from the earlier arrest. Mm-hmm. So she was eventually sentenced to a total of 80 years in a plea bargain.
She has served her time, and she has not only been a model prisoner, but she has become a poet of some note, widely published, is highly acclaimed, and there's a wide movement supporting her and supporting her release. Her poetry has not only been published widely, but it also has been widely read by those, including Marion Wizard.
Bring me out, mine the wild abandon that was mine once when I was 17, a young wraith in black, bells ringing in flight, wrapped around a young man's back, on a BMW that wound up mountains to a naked lunch atop ice-planted crags pounded by the Pacific. Once when I was 30, entrancing from clandestine curtained brilliance, a subversive siren in a sea of easily parted waves of dark-eyed lovers. Awaken passion one more time. I am in danger. The zodiac abandons me to landlocked shadows that smother me flat. I cannot breathe without the vivid rainbow's edge. Find me, free me from these pale, dry days. Drown me in torrential floods. End this drought of drab restraint.
That was Marion Wizard reading a Marilyn Buck poem and was off the CD Wild Poppies, a poetry jam across prison walls produced by the Freedom Archives. Again, you are listening to audio from Rag Radio, recorded June 22nd. Marilyn was released from prison on July 15th, but at the time of the recording, she was still locked up. Here is Marion Wizard.
She was confined at Dublin Federal Correctional Institute in California for most of the last 15 years. When she was first convicted of these crimes, she was sent to a prison in Marianna, Florida, which was later decommissioned after court cases found it to be a completely cruel and unusual punishment to even keep people in this place.
Yeah.
It was one of those 23-hour-a-day lockdown supermax facilities. Right now, she's in Fort Worth at the Federal Medical Center at Carswell. Marilyn is scheduled for release on parole in August, and that was granted to her after many years of effort just last year. Unfortunately, in December, she was diagnosed with a very serious cancer, and she's now receiving chemotherapy for that at the Federal Prison Hospital. And so, theoretically, the chemo is going to be done at about the same time that she's supposed to be released. Her lawyers are working to have the terms of her parole amended to allow her to have some time to rest and recuperate.
You are listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO Portland.
In Dallas.
Is there a way that people can learn more about Marilyn? Well, one thing is that Marion wrote a tremendous article about Marilyn Buck that was in the Rag Blog.
Our warrior poet.
Warrior poet, no wall too high. And you can, it's in the ragblog.blogspot.com. You can go to the Rag Blog and then you can just search Marion Wizard or you can search Marilyn Buck or whatever on the Rag Blog. Is there a way that people who are not in town can find out more and can perhaps donate? Do you have that address?
Yes. If people would like to send a check, they can write a check to Youth Emergency Service Incorporated and send it to Post Office Box 13549, 13549, that is, in Austin, Texas, 78711, and just mark it for Marilyn, and everything will go to her support committee.
Matt Meyer is an educator activist based in New York City. He has long worked to bring together academics and activists for lasting social change. A former public draft registration resister and chair of the War Resisters League, he continues to serve as convener of the War Resisters International Africa Working Group. This audio was recorded Tuesday, April 14th, 2009, at Blue Stocking Books in New York City.
I'm going to close reading a brief excerpt from a woman who was imprisoned and is in prison because of her political work and her political beliefs, Marilyn Buck. Marilyn Buck is a white anti-imperialist who's in prison on the West Coast, but hopefully looks like she actually has a release date. Marilyn Buck was active in the anti-war and feminist movements of the 1960s and 70s, and was part of the Students for a Democratic Society of that era, and was actually one of the, if not the only woman, who was ever accused of being a member of the Black Liberation Army. Marilyn was asked, along with other political prisoners, to reflect upon the radical and militant abolitionist John Brown on his 200th birthday. She wrote the following, which I'll just read to you. This is Marilyn Buck on John Brown. On the 200th anniversary of John Brown's birth, I would like to propose that we imagine who John Brown would be were his bones to rise up from the grave today and stand presente. Likely, old J.B. would reincarnate as a woman, picking up where he left off, or rather had fallen short, in his ideological development. Johnette would be engaged in organizing against the death penalty and to free Mumia Abu-Jamal, alongside the growing number of activists from their communities, hip-hoppers and anti-racist punks, radical rappers, salseros and rockers. She would join the upsurge of resistance and refusal in the face of the increasingly militarized police state. The sights are set on liberation, and they know that there can be no liberation or justice or peace where there is white supremacy, where there is exclusion due to hierarchy, nation, race, class, or gender. Jarnett and her comrades bring a legacy of courage and creativity. She would be happy to feel the winds of change, even in the stultifying swamp of injustice. Again, in this life, she would experience the possibilities of liberation inherent in challenging oppression and in preserving the planet for all peoples and their future generations. She would not be afraid to fight for that future. She might well repeat a slogan she'd heard from some old Black Panthers. You're either part of the problem or part of the solution. And with some of that old John Brown fire in her eyes, she might ask, which side are you on? Thank you.
That was Matt Meyer, editor of Let Freedom Ring, a collection of documents from the movements to free U.S. political prisoners. Let Freedom Ring brings a two-decade sweep of essays, analysis, histories, interviews, resolutions, people's tribunal verdicts, and poems by and about the scores of U.S. political prisoners and the campaigns to safeguard their rights and secure their freedom. We'll now hear from a contributor to that book, Dan Berger. This interview is mostly based on Berger's essay, The Real Dragons, A Brief History of Political Militancy and Incarceration, the 1960s to the 2000s.
I started on the project from having so many friends and mentors who are locked up and doing work around political prisoner issues for the past dozen years. Casually along the way, I've sort of learned or heard that in the 70s was when a lot of stuff was happening, looking around and not seeing a whole lot written about that movement as a sort of self-defined prison movement. And even in a lot of the really great, exciting work on black power that's coming out in recent years, the prison movement doesn't get mentioned oftentimes, certainly not described. And so, you know, what attracted me to it is wanting to know personally and trying to find it and then not seeing it. And so deciding that I should write it with all due humility. This needs to exist. We need to be able to learn from history. We need to know where we're coming from in order to figure out, you know, where we are and where we want to go. That was a big piece of it. And doing work around the prison industrial complex and the buildup of mass incarceration and, you know, militarized policing in the United States, you know, a lot of that really took shape in the 80s, but started earlier. Certainly since Nixon's election in 1968. And so there again, the 70s are this really pivotal moment. And I think leaving the 70s, the right wins at the policy level. But, you know, the left had really scored some key policy victories, you know, that the right rolled back, but also a certain victory of consciousness in terms of the political culture within prisons that I don't think is the same now as it was then. But I think trying to learn from the audacious and inspiring organizing victories of folks who are able to come together despite tremendous physical isolation, right? It seems like part of the way that prisons work is, you know, separating them from society, but society from folks inside. And so, you know, all manner of brutality and mistreatment that happens there. Also, what's really inspiring about the 70s prisoner movement and political prisoner organizing in the 70s that I'm looking at is, you know, the sense that people weren't just trying to improve their immediate conditions of ending brutality or improving their treatment inside, valuable as those goals are, but actually putting prisoners in a strategic way as part of the oppressed and in some sense part of leadership. And I think that's like a really complicated issue that certainly wasn't figured out at the time, and I don't think we figured out today, but that notion that prisoners could be intellectuals, could be theorists, could be movement leaders, that prisoners had a lot to say, I think is really powerful. I think prisoners, some prisoners, many prisoners understood that. And I think, you know, you have about 48, I think, prison riots in just a few year period, which is the most that had ever happened in U.S. history. So there was this tremendous sense of action, but also there was people were writing, were publishing, were sort of contributing to this political culture of resistance, to this climate of resistance that I think was able to recognize their position as prisoners and usually as survivors of white supremacy, black and Puerto Rican prisoners, and being able to view their conditions of confinement in relation to broader systems of domination in the U.S.
Could you briefly cite one story that you find particularly inspiring?
I'm looking at a couple of main case studies. One is the orbit around George Jackson, and one is the campaign to free the five Puerto Rican nationalists who were freed in 1979 as a result of a dramatic and international campaign. The five nationalists were arrested in the 50s, one arrested in 1950 for trying to shoot President Truman, and four arrested in 1954 for shooting up U.S. Congress. And after they were arrested, they were tried and incarcerated and really, you know, almost forgotten about by most people. And when the Puerto Rican independence movement started to grow in the late 60s and on through the 70s, people started to look again at the folks who were locked up. I think there was a sense, you know, that movements, successful movements, are going to face repression, and that therefore part of movement continuing to succeed and sort of ultimately succeeding in transforming power relations in significant ways required combating repression, required defeating repression. And so I think that analysis led people to really fight for the release of political prisoners. And I think in the Puerto Rican example, it extended from the island of Puerto Rico to the barrios in the U.S. to a whole range of international human rights work that was able to free all five in a successful campaign that were able to walk out of prison unrepentant, equally radical, and able to rejoin the struggle after being, you know, almost forgotten about for almost 20 years, I think is really impressive. You know, the other thing that I'll mention, just part of the case study, is looking at the case of the San Quentin Six, which were six Black and Latino prisoners who were tried after the death of George Jackson in August of 1971, and their case didn't go to trial until 1975. Ultimately, you know, it was a mixed verdict, although most of them were acquitted. The one that was convicted of the most serious charges was Johnny Spain, who was the only Panther of the bunch. His case was ultimately won in the 80s, and he is now free. But I think that sense of the state being able to wear you down is a really key aspect of that case, because these folks were, you know, again, George Jackson's murdered in 1971. They don't really come to trial until the mid-70s. It's another several years before, almost 10 years before Johnny Spain gets out. So I think, you know, there's this notion of being in the struggle for the long haul that I think is really important and often hard for younger folks to hold on to. And I think part of that is really being able to have a sense of commitment to sets of principles, but also to projects and campaigns, and really being able to see them through in a way that avoids sectarianism, that avoids being lost, or being unable to transmit those issues to broader groups of people. And sort of this constant tension between being grounded in people's needs and trying to bring issues, campaigns, projects to them. But I think the state counts on our ability to not hold on, to not respond to these outrages, and to not stay around for the long haul. And so I think we really need to have that longevity and be able to stay around and win. Hugo Pinal is the one member of the San Quentin Six who is still incarcerated. Hugo Pinal is a comrade of George Jackson's, has been in prison since the 60s, and like George and like most of the Six, was somebody who was not arrested for political acts, and who became politicized in prison and joined the prison movement and became, you know, a leading figure on the inside as well as someone on the outside who was able to do a lot of bridge building between Black and brown populations in prison. But Hugo is a Black Nicaraguan. As punishment for his ongoing political affiliations, his ongoing political work, and just the symbolism that I think he represents, he's been held in Pelican Bay, which is one of the worst prisons that the U.S. has. A super repressive maximum security prison within a prison isolation unit. Institutions like Pelican Bay are the vanguard of state terror. They are attempts to crush human beings and forestall the ability of any sort of resistance or imagination or beauty. Someone who has endured those conditions for so long deserves humanitarian release on its own right. That's not enough, but I think, or won't be enough in terms of the state's perspective, but I think we need to do a lot to certainly get rid of these super maximum prisons, these isolation units, the sort of torture that is confinement in the U.S. So I think a victory like getting Hugo Pinal released would be an important step in campaigns to abolish control units and the like. I think any time a political prisoner comes home is a tremendous victory for our movements.
That was Dan Berger, a contributor to the book Let Freedom Ring, a collection of documents from the movements to free U.S. political prisoners. Marilyn Buck was also a contributor to that book. We'll now hear from Robert King, one of the Angola Three. The Angola Three also includes Albert Woodfox and Herman Wallace. While inside prison, they organize prisoners to build a movement to desegregate the prison, to end systematic rape and violence, for better living conditions, and also worked as jailhouse lawyers, helping prisoners file legal papers. In 1972, Woodfox and Wallace were convicted of stabbing murder of 23-year-old prison guard. Robert King was said by the authorities to be linked to the murder, and on the grounds that King, quote, wanted to play lawyer for another inmate, he was immediately put into solitary confinement, where he remained for 29 years until his 2001 release. Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox are still prisoners in Angola prison and are working to get released. In March 2008, they were moved after 36 years from solitary confinement to a maximum security dormitory. Robert King was a guest on Rag Radio from KOOP in Austin, Texas, on June 22, 2010.
What about the question of political prisoners? There are political prisoners in this country. There are quite a few of them, and some of them have been locked up for a long time.
Well, yes, there's been a debate on as to what constitutes.
What is a political prisoner?
What is a political prisoner? I mean, it depends. Just use your interpretation. I would like to raise the barometer and the bar for everyone. Some people believe that if you were, of course, married, people like Marion Buck, Leonard Peltier, Mamiya, Angola Three, and we can name all those whom we know. Of course, they are considered political prisoners because the church report shows that the Black Panther Party or any member of the Black Panther Party who now resides in prison can be considered a political prisoner in the sense that the church reports validate and verify that the Black Panther Party, of all organizations, it was targeted most. And so for county insurgency. And so we know Geronimo G. Jago was an individual that we know was targeted by the FBI. The same thing that put him in prison was the same thing that freed him from prison. But I would like to go further with the concept of what constitutes political prisoners. I would like to think that, you know, I would like to look at it from a much broader perspective. I would like to look at it from a standpoint that, you know, slavery still exists in the form of prison. You know, I would like to think that de facto slavery resides in America, has always resided in America, and it has taken on the form, like I said, prison. And so I am saying this, that some people think that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. It did not. It said except one who has been duly convicted of a crime. Yeah, it says, you know, slavery or involuntary. That's rhetoric. Won't exist in this land, except a person who has been duly convicted of a crime. Well, how many people have been duly convicted of a crime, but nevertheless, they still remain in prison? I would like to point out that, you know, a person can be legally confined in prison, but they could be morally innocent of any crime. And some people think that if it's legal, it's moral, it's whole, it's correct, but that's not so. It was legal to own slaves. It wasn't until the people saw that it was morally reprehensible that they changed this. And so a lot of time you could be a legal slave, and I think prison is a form of legal slave that allow all of us to be, if not political prisoners, to become political victims.
Yeah, your point is well taken. I think a lot of people were shocked when Leonard Peltier did not receive parole this past I think a lot of people thought finally he was going to get that.
It was pointed out to me this week because the question has arisen. Some people have said that Marilyn Buck is not a political prisoner because regardless of her motivations, she committed criminal acts. And it was pointed out very wisely, I think, that the definition really of the political prisoner is not in what the person has done, it is in how the government responds to you. In other words, if she committed criminal acts, she did not receive a sentence that was proportionate to those acts, she received a political sentence.
Political victims, and this is why we have to broaden the concept
beyond
what amnesty may say.
Exactly.
That was Robert King and Marion Wizard on Coop's Rag Radio. You are listening to Circle A Radio, where tonight we celebrate the release of Marilyn Buck from prison after 25 years. We also are discussing other political prisoners in the United States. Next up, we'll hear an interview conducted by Davey D on Hard Knock Radio with former political prisoner Linda Evans and Bay Area activist and organizer with the East Side Arts Alliance in Oakland, California, Maisha Quint. Linda Evans,
inside the prisons, we try to maintain an active and useful political life, and also we interact with all the other prisoners in a political manner. So people come to us constantly for political education, for books, for perspectives, and we actually have a rich political life inside, not just relating to issues that come up in the streets, but also a lot of racism, a lot of conditions issues that arise inside the prison. All the political prisoners have really played an important role in galvanizing some of the resistance to real inhumane conditions that exist, you know, throughout all of the prison systems. I can think of one other little example. Several years ago, when I was still locked up with Marilyn, the prison officials at FCI Dublin wanted to solder closed the little metal slots, window slots that we had that were the only way for us to get fresh air. So we organized people to really resist that. Marilyn was very fundamental in that organizing, and they didn't do it for many, many years. Unfortunately, they did do it. They finally did solder closed all the windows. I think it was last year at Dublin, but that level of continual resistance and feeling power, even though we're humiliated and degraded in prison, is really important. And Marilyn has played a very key role in that. I think another way that we maintain ourselves, and Marilyn is a very, very good example of this, is by giving service to other prisoners. So
right.
I know for a fact that practically every morning when I was locked up with her, Marilyn was up at 5 o'clock tutoring some of the younger women that we were locked up with. The education system has failed so badly, people don't know how to read. The service that all of us were able to give, really, you know, you get a lot from that. And it's a real give-back situation where the prisoners that benefit from the tutoring give back in love and support for us, and it's a very mutual relationship that's very, very important.
If you're just tuning in, that's the voice of Linda Evans, longtime activist and former political prisoner. We're talking about Marilyn Buck.
I think what we have to look at is that there are a lot of different kinds of prosecutions that are going on, right? It's not just black and white here. We have all the regular prosecutions, the way that the war on drugs has really been a total war on black and brown people. And then you have politically pointed prosecutions,
right,
like the ones that were used in the Cointelpro sweeps and against political prisoners generally and against political activists. I think that it's really incumbent on us to try to press the school systems, to try to press the media outlets for coverage of things that are important, not just the superficial stuff that they want us to think about so we'll forget reality.
Well, I mean, at the very least, as I'm sitting here listening to you, Linda Evans, maybe the school can't talk about a Marilyn Buck or Leonard Peltier, but the schools damn well should be able to have a curriculum to say why you shouldn't be going to prison at all.
Right.
You know, let's just, that everybody can agree with that. Can we get a comprehensive,
yeah,
you know, curriculum that tells you why you should not be going to prison? And I bet you if we even put that up there, you would see resistance, you know,
yeah.
But I think that's a worthwhile fight to be like, you know what, starting at age 8 or 9 or 10, we're going to go in these schools and we're going to give you a whole thing about how prisons are built, who makes money, mm-hmm, what goes on, and why you shouldn't be in these prisons. And start that sort of campaign and then see, and then watch very carefully to see who comes out and starts to, you know, lead the charge. No, we shouldn't talk about prisons in school. Well, why not when the people in this community are going to prison?
Right, when the pipeline between schools and prisons,
yeah,
is so strong.
When their parents are going to prison.
Yeah.
And when the young people themselves are, you know, and there's a lot of good folks that are doing just that, Davey. It's good you talk about, you know, that have put together a juvenile justice curriculum and are definitely teaching their own youth groups about it. But to get it into the schools would be amazing.
Well,
and,
maybe
you know,
that's the goal we do for 2010.
Exactly. You know, try to really get those into the wider school system. And I think another reason that that Marilyn is also essential to this conversation and taps onto what Linda was saying is just the role of culture and how to use it for education, you know, because what we do at Eastside is, you know, we really believe that culture is a necessary weapon, you know, in the freedom struggle. And that was something that Malcolm said years and years ago. And that's something that Hard Knock is doing. You know, how do we use culture to educate, to agitate, to rebel, and to change? You know, and how do we change the cultural world of how we talk about this? And so pressing media and demanding these things in the school systems and making sure that art is being used as a right. language to talk about this. And that's how.
Well, art has been used to make jail attractive. That's what's so crazy about it. It's yeah. been used to make it attracted by people who don't go to jail. You know, you get some of these people talking about, yeah, you know, we're going to this, that, and the other, talking all this crazy stuff. It's like, you never been to jail.
Right.
You haven't even gone just to talk to people. I've been to talk to people, and I come out depressed, and I come out like, I don't want to have to be there. It's almost like a disrespect.
Exactly.
You know, to the people that are there. Like, exactly. you just glamorizing something, and, right. you know, I'm seeing people like, yo, y'all got to live like this for real? And then you got somebody who's like, yo, Sean, we going to, you know, we sitting there starting to talk all this crazy stuff like they're the tough guy on the block.
And that's how, you know, culture is so important. So yeah. then you go to a poem that Marilyn's written about the conditions inside. You go see a mural that Fabiana's done or Estria has done or Rifa has done that shows, first of all, how small a real prison cell is, that you have six people in it and the conditions like that. You go, we have to change the kind of cultural landscape, you know? So when we have someone up there talking that mess that has no idea what they're talking about, our young people can say, well, wait, I remember that song the Dead Prez did about prisons, and it didn't sound anything like that.
Right.
Or I remember a poem that I just heard at an open mic, and it didn't sound anything like that.
We can make the message simple. Go ahead. What were you going to say, Linda?
Also that people can take a stand and it can make a difference.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, because for artists, prison is death. I mean, it really, really is. In the California system, 180,000 people in there, huge numbers of talented artists cannot get a single stick of art supplies. So the art that really helps sustain people in prison, which I was fortunate to, you know, I was in there a while ago and was able to do things like make quilts to give away. We had a sewing program. We had a recreation program where people could do pottery and stuff. And if you see, Marilyn has benefited from that also. Her sculpture is incredible. Her writing is incredible. Her translation. She went to some of that after her hands got so sore from trying to use clay that she started to do more writing. But it's really serious how the conditions inside the prisons are steadily deteriorating, even on the level of food and water. The water in some of our prisons is toxic. People develop cancer because they have been drinking poisoned water. So I really feel that artists and the community at large needs to embrace people coming back from prison and then stand up against the policies that mean that so many people are going mass incarceration and work to release our political leaders. We're lucky that Marilyn is coming out, and I just think that that means that we have to renew our hope of getting some of the other comrades out as well.
That's real talk right there.
I think that we need to really look to Marilyn's release as a way to move forward toward opposing the growth of the prison system in general, but also to really oppose the further incarceration and continued imprisonment of our political prisoners.
I would just add, you know, I think what it continues to remind me is the necessity that we have to do at the ground level, the grassroots level, and this is what we're doing at Eastside, in really making connections between communities. We have to make the connection between Black and Brown communities, that what is happening on the federal level with prisons, that's what's happening with the detention centers, is exactly what's been happening in the Black community. And so we have to really make that investment known. So Black, not only are our immigrant communities outraged, but Black communities are outraged, right? When this happens. And I think this is where I look to our political prisoners, because I look to their voices, because they understand this so clearly, mostly because they lived through this already. You know, they lived through this in the 60s and 70s when all of these liberation movements were kind of happening at the same time. And so I look to hear Leonard Peltier's voice about this. I look to Mumia's voice. I look to Alex Sanchez's voice and Herman Bell's voice and Chip Fitzgerald and Marilyn Buck. That's not to say that we only focus on political prisoners, but we look to them and we continue fighting for them because they inform the rest of the landscape for this. And they can ground our freedom struggles for everyone that's facing incarceration.
That's the voice of Maisha Quint. You also heard the voice of Linda Evans.
That was Linda Evans, Maisha Quint, and Davy D. On Monday, July 26, 2010, a group of more than 50 family members, friends, and supporters of Puerto Rican political prisoner Carlos Alberto Torres went to Pinckney, Illinois, to be on hand as Carlos was released from prison after 30 years of incarceration. Carlos Alberto Torres was born in Puerto Rico on September 19, 1952. In 1976, Carlos was forced to go underground and was on the FBI's most wanted list. He was captured along with other comrades and sentenced to 78 years on charges of carrying a firearm and seditious conspiracy, conspiring to use force against the lawful authority of the United States over Puerto Rico, or, less officially, engaging as a member of the Puerto Rican Independence Group, the FALN, the Armed Forces for National Liberation, in revolutionary struggle for the liberation of the colony from the United States. Here is Carlos Alberto Torres speaking at the public event at La Casita de Don Pedro to over 500 people.
This is a happy day for my family, but it's my victory, but it's really your victory. I think, without a doubt, if it wasn't for the effort and the interest and the love that all of you have given, and this day would not have been possible. So I feel honored being in front of you, and thank you. Viva Puerto Rico!
Here is audio from an art exhibit, Not Enough Space. Not Enough Space was a traveling art exhibit which presented the story of two Puerto Rican fathers, grandfathers, community organizers, self-taught artists, and political prisoners, Carlos Alberto Torres and Oscar Lopez Rivera. This is Carlos Alberto Torres.
My name is Carlos Alberto Torres. I am a Puerto Rican political prisoner. With this art exhibit, the recording of my voice, and the facsimile prison cell, I wish to convey to you a little about myself, why I'm incarcerated, and some thoughts on prison and art. I have been in prison for 25 years. In 1980, the United States government arrested and charged me and 10 others with seditious conspiracy. That is, we were accused of conspiring to overthrow the government of the United States in Puerto Rico. This charge originated as a response to our participation in the Puerto Rican independence movement and as a reaction by the U.S. government to put down what was then a growing armed resistance movement to its century-long colonial occupation of Puerto Rico, an occupation that began in 1898 and has variously defined Puerto Rico as a territory of the United States, as a possession of the United States, as belonging to but not a part of the United States. Today, Puerto Rico continues to be ruled from Washington. Puerto Rico is a nation that does not rule her own destiny. It is a colony of the United States, although many terms are used to deflect from this fact. It is a colony of the U.S., although colonialism is morally repugnant to most people and is repudiated by the majority of nations of the world. From an individual point of view, when juxtaposed over 25 years of unjust incarceration, the pride and loyalty that I feel for my homeland of Puerto Rico has meant a personal sacrifice, not only for me, but for many people and loved ones. Yet I feel that the inherent good of defending my country's future from further external control is an imperative that all good people of conscience should not ignore. If history has taught us anything, it is that the price of freedom is always high. Throughout my imprisonment, I have witnessed what long confinement can do to some. Long periods of incarceration can very often distort a personality and defeat a person. One can, however, live through a long confinement and survive, more than survive. Many years of incarceration can also act to distill and drive to the surface the essential you, one's truer self, in prison, there is generally no place to hide except within yourself. So how we deal with the truth about ourselves and those around us can mean the difference between personal growth or personal failure. How we brave the angry promise by the state to deprive us of our freedom while still preserving the ideals and the values that make us whole is the difference between victory or defeat. Our personal victory is to keep alive a spirit of liberation while confronting the soul-numbing isolation of imprisonment. The greatest challenge, after all, is not just to survive this experience, but to persevere and thrive, to know freedom even from behind these walls. Anytime we can overcome the fears that impede our progress and instead act with courage is to know freedom. Anytime we can unleash our creativity and give full rein to our creative will is to know freedom. Art nurtures creation. It is a life force. Art inspires. To have art in our life is to taste freedom. Given the sterility of prison and the constraint it places on the individual, art is a song to joy. An affirmation of life. This, then, is one step in defense of freedom and two on the road to liberation. Thank you.
Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, is immediate past president of the National Lawyers Guild, Deputy Secretary General of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and the U.S. Representative to the Executive Council of the American Association of Jurists. She wrote the following in the July 26th edition of Counterpunch. Carlos Alberto Torres's attorney, National Lawyers Guild member Jan Sessler of Chicago, notes, Carlos is being released from prison due to the unflagging support of the Puerto Rican independence movement and others who work for human rights. The more than 10,000 letters of support from the U.S., Puerto Rico, Mexico, and other countries sent a strong message to the Parole Commission. Yet there is a damper on the celebration, as Torres leaves behind his compatriot Oscar Lopez, a 67-year-old decorated Vietnam veteran. Lopez did not accept the terms of President Clinton's 1999 clemency offer, which would have required him to serve an additional 10 years in prison with good conduct. Though he declined the offer, Lopez has now served the additional 10 years in prison with good conduct. Had he accepted the deal, he would have been released last September. Those who did accept are living successful lives, fully integrated into civil society. There is no reason to treat him differently. While we celebrate this remarkable day in the life of Torres and the movement for Puerto Rican independence, let us commit ourselves to continue to struggle until Oscar Lopez Rivera and Avelino Gonzalez Claudio, as well as all political prisoners in U.S. prisons, also walk free.
La fuerza sin el miedo del cañón, como un salvaje en el monte, sirviendo a mi corazón, por mi raza, por mi sangre, por la fe de mi tambor, con una marca en la espalda, reflejo de mi color. Yo me llamo libertad, libertad, mi apellido es Cimarrón, libre y soberano, libre, 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 libre. Y es que tengo a mis ancestros dándome las direcciones, limpiándome los caminos, aguantando los azotes por la ruta de la caña, de la brea y el mogote, para limpiarle las lagañas, todas mis ilusiones. Me fugué de los cuerrazos para trabajar los dolores, para servir de mayordomo y alcahuete a los millones. Pero me encontré la patria en la esquina de mi alma y fui corriendo sin calma para conocer la historia que guardaban mis ancestros, y aprendí a aguantar dolor y a reírme desde lejos para disfrazar la rabia que trae dolor ajeno. Por la era de Trujillo nunca conocí a mi abuelo, cuando se invirtió la tierra por el miedo y el respeto, cuando gritar por justicia era decir hombre muerto, y el chivo era el león de la jungla de concreto, y el tirano nos decía el bien hay que imponerlo, pero el pueblo despertaba del dolor y del silencio, y Minerva bofechete del imperio cuando el alma preguntaba.
Lolita Lebron, an active advocate for Puerto Rican independence, died on August 1st, 2010. Born in Puerto Rico in 1919, she migrated to New York City in 1941. That was where she joined the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party. Within the organization, she promoted ideals based on socialist and feminist principles. In 1952, after Puerto Rico's official status was changed to Commonwealth, the Nationalist Party began a series of revolutionary actions. she organized attacks in the United States, focusing on locations that were, quote, the most strategic to the enemy. She became the leader of a group of nationalists. Four of them proceeded to attack the United States House of Representatives in 1954. Here is audio from the 1954 attack provided by the Freedom Archives.
Nosotros, los puertorriqueños, y todos los oprimidos por el terror y la violencia, hemos tenido que acudir, y no vacilará Puerto Rico, si necesario fuera, a este último recurso de las nacionalidades, que es el uso de las armas para realizar su emancipación nacional. El imperio norteamericano se obstina en su ocupación de nuestro país y nos provoca día a día y noche a noche a la defensa de nuestra dignidad nacional. Somos víctimas de su violencia y de su terror. Nosotros hemos tratado todos los medios pacíficos en cuyo proceso el enemigo norteamericano se ha fortalecido.
More than 240 House members were debating an immigration bill when bullets started whizzing overhead, slamming into marble columns, splintering wood. Witnesses said that they could hear Lolita's voice above the commotion. Viva Puerto Rico Libre! Long live free Puerto Rico, she yelled, as she and her compatriots unfurled a Puerto Rican flag and shot weapons. Police found a handwritten note in her purse. Before God and the world, my blood claims for the independence of Puerto Rico. My life I give for the freedom of my country. This is a cry for victory in our struggle for independence. The United States of America are betraying the sacred principles of mankind in their continuous subjugation of my country. I take responsibility for all. All the attackers were given minimum sentences of 70 years in prison. After spending 25 years in prison, Jimmy Carter issued pardons to the group. After their release in 1981, the Nationalists returned to Puerto Rico, where independence movements received them with a celebration. During the following years, she continued her involvement in pro-independence activities, including the Nieve Vieques protests. Her life would be subsequently detailed in books and a documentary. She died August 1st from complications of a cardiorespiratory infection. This is poet Michael Reyes performing Lolita, You May Cry Now.
She told us that while she was incarcerated for 25 years, she did not cry a tear to show that that her spirit couldn't be broken. And while we were eating dinner with her, she had mentioned that after she had been out of prison for 25 years, that it was very difficult for her to cry. And so I wrote this poem and presented it to Lolita at the Bate Urbano and was able to share with her an experience that we had a whole week long of events for her. So with that, I'll present to you Lolita, You May Cry Now. Lolita, you may cry now, tears to the oppressed, hungry for food, knowledge, and hope. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for the millions of upon millions of indigenous peoples of the Americas, tears for those names, languages, customs, and cultures we will never know, lost like the leaves that fall into the streams and rivers. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for the African slaves that were chained, shackled, raped, and whipped, their back dripping with red teardrops of their own. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for those who worked and toiled, tears of sweat dripping in the soil that they blessed to cultivate so others could prosper from their suffering. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for the massacres, broken treaties, diseases, death, stolen land and nature. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for the murdered Mexicans, lynched, hung, dragged, cut, shot in the southwest of the United States. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for those who worked the large sugarcane plantations and never had a chance to taste. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for the cries of independence and freedom on September 16, 1810, Grito de Dolores, tears for Grito de Elade, September 23, 1868. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for Betances and Segundo Ruiz Belvis, and for all of those who fought tyranny, injustice, and treachery in your land. Lolita, you may cry now, tears for the prisoners of war of 1898, tears for Luis Ocampos in and out of prison for more than 25 years, tears for the radiation his body was exposed to, like the children of Yekis crying contaminated tears for lost souls. Tears for POWs of 1954 and 1980, for Rafael Casajel Miranda, Andres Figueroa Cordero, Irving Flores Rodriguez, tears for Alejandrina Torres, Carlos Alberto Torres, Cicia Pagan, Oscar Lopez Rivera, and all of the prisoners of war from the movement. Tears for all of those who gave us vision through the rough storm, steady and calm, they steered us clear. Tears for Juan Antonio Corajed, tears for Consuelo Lee Corajed, and tears for our beloved mystic from Chicago, Jose Lopez. The love for his people shown in the humblest of ways, from the picking up of trash to the enormous vision he puts forth. And tears for all of those who make up our community. Tears for those in the space, the Bate Urbano, the Bate Collective, the people I call my comrades, my closest and dearest friends, the people that have helped me feel human once again. And tears for all of those who are the faces and crowds and actions against the occupation of Palestine and Iraq. And tears for the people of Gehi's voices unheard. Tears for the undocumented workers that toil in the belly of the beast with no rights, vocal cords that have been ripped out. Tears for Cuba, Venezuela, Brazil, Jaffa, for they stand in the shadow of a giant and do not budge from what is just, what is right, and what is equal. And tears for you, Lolita. Tears for your strength, your endurance, and constant resistance. Yes, Lolita, you may cry now. Tears for the times away from loved ones. Tears for the times that they tried to break you and you stood fearless, challenging an empire, standing like a mountain against a hurricane's attack. Tears for the times that you could not feel the warmth of the sun or the warmth of a loving hand. Tears for lost memories. Tears to fill the ocean's depths. Tears for all the times that you wanted to cry but could not, to show them that you were unbreakable. Yes, Lolita, you may cry now. Tears of sadness and tears of joy because our freedom will come. Lolita, you may cry now, and if you cannot, you are home, and we all will cry for you.
That was Michael Reyes. We'd like to thank Rag Radio, Rise Up Radio, Hard Knock Radio, PM Press, Archive.org, and the Freedom Archives for providing audio for tonight's program. We will have links and information on our website, kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. Circle A Radio can be heard the first and third Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. You can contact us at circlearadio@gmail.com or at kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. Thanks for listening.
So far away in a boondocks, few people could possibly visit. Would you be with it, shipped off to so many different prisons? Anyone who finds you shows interest must elicit suspicion in their attempt to have you spiritually diminished. They try to dehumanize you by the minute with the hopes of reducing you to digits. Would you still have the ability to live from this lockdown position? Hear those move for freedom in your tradition. And could you leave behind your family knowing how much you'll miss them? Your wife and children probably never get to touch them or kiss them. Would you be the ignition to our resistance? Would you rob the rich for the poor subsistence to heal our attrition in the face of sedition? Can you come to the decision? No matter what happens, we must complete the mission of Puerto Rico's upliftment.